This week in Retronauts, it's all karaoke, all the time. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. And I was just kidding. You don't actually have to listen to us sing. I wouldn't do that to you. I'm your kind and compassionate host, Jeremy Parrish, host for this episode. And we're going to talk about game music. Why don't you other people introduce yourselves?
I'm going to go first. I'm Bob Mackey, and you know who I am. That's all I'll say.
I'm Ray Barnholt. Hello.
And not that it matters to anyone who's not in the room with us, but to my left is our very first backer co-host for the Retronauts Kickstarter venture, whatever, Volume 3. Yes. Introduce yourself.
My name is James Eldred.
And
you know, stuff.
What's your story, James?
Yeah, what brings you here?
I gave a lot of money and I showed up. And I'm, if you know a lot about me, I'm a writer. I write about music for the most part. And I did one article for 1UP once a long time ago.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. What was that?
I wrote about accessories for the Atari 2600.
Yes.
I actually read that.
That was during the 2600 cover story week.
Yeah, because you put a call out on Twitter because everyone who was writing for 1UP was too young.
Right.
And I'm old, yes. So it worked out great.
Excellent. Yeah, I totally forgot about that. Thanks for contributing that. Did Ziff Davis ever pay you?
Nope.
What the hell?
Yeah.
We need a special grievances section podcast.
I could make a grievances book on all the different clients. We could just make this a podcast about people who don't pay.
Let's start complaining about freelancing.
Yeah. All right. But no one is actually going to to hear about that. So let's not do that.
Yay.
Instead, let's talk about video game music. Now, Retronauts has talked about video game music once long in the past in an episode that we can't actually post within our podcast feed because of legal reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to just, you know, rehash that old content. Instead, what I'd like to do is look less as a survey of our favorite game composers and soundtracks and more a look at the actual sort of history and evolution of game music. And I think, Ray, you'll be an excellent participant in this episode because it's kind of a passion for you.
I suppose so. Yes.
It's okay to say yes.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not too into it right
now. You had a game music podcast, yeah. Ray Barnholt.
No one else in this room can say that yet.
Yes. I'm aware of that. Yeah.
I had a podcast that with an true. Episode about game music. You had an entire podcast about game music.
Yes.
So you're MVP. And of course, James.
And yeah, really.
I have two blogs where I occasionally talk about game music. So
do those blogs, what do those blogs normally cover? And what are their URLs?
I have one called LostTurntable.com, which is also my Twitter handle, and I talk about, I pretty much, it's an MP3 blog where I post out-of-print music, so it's not, you know, all the way legal, but...
But it's out-of-print, so no one cares.
And yeah. I don't have any ads, I lose money on it, so it's right. Not like I do when it's like that. And I'll occasionally put some video game stuff on now, and when we get to the soundtracks, I can talk about that.
Hey, do you have MP3s of Billy Joel's pre-musical career band, the Attilas?
If it's on vinyl, I could get it.
All right. I've been wanting to find that.
And I have another site that I just launched earlier this year called mostlyretro.com. And that's mostly then a hyphen and then retro. And I'm mostly known for that, for writing something about, what's his name? The Earthworm Jim guy. And then getting a bunch of angry hate mail.
Oh, Tallarico? No. Doug Tenapple.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and he's an easy guy to say things about.
And I occasionally, that's a kind of all-encompassing music, movies, games, and I talk about, a while ago I put up some MP3s from some old kid stuff video game records.
Mm.
It's pretty funny. So stuff like
Tell
that.
Tell me, what are the kid stuff video game records? What are those exactly? I have never heard of those.
I know you... Bob, you put up a picture of one. It was a Pac-Man one. So Kid Stuff was a label from the late 70s to the mid 80s. It was all pretty much one guy whose name I forgot. And he released all these, like, and if you bought like a Smurfs record back in the 80s, it was him. And all these other, like, Planet of the Apes and stuff like that. And he put out a bunch of Pac-Man records, like with story records of music. Huh. And they're all just the worst stuff in the world.
Yeah.
And then he put out three that are kind of interesting. There's an Asteroids, a Yars Revenge, and a Missile Command one. And they have stories and music. And the stories are usually pretty interesting. Like, they completely changed the plot of Missile Command, so it's no longer, you know, World War III.
Mm.
And the music...
What? They changed the canon?
I know.
That's unacceptable.
Oh, man, the Asteroid storyline's pretty great. And then all this music is all, like, early 80s electro.
Yeah, I remember in those Pac-Man books, it would just be a story that was read to you, but occasionally there'd be mazes in the books, and they would play a song, like, go through the maze while this song plays, because I guess they're trying to approximate the Pac-Man experience
right.
in storybook form. But I remember the music just being crazy, like, synthesized
yeah.
stuff. It was actually kind of frightening as a child, you know.
What's really frightening is that the Asteroids music, one of the songs is actually kind of good. Like, it's not like great, but it's entertaining, and they're really bad though.
Those are fantastic, but those aren't actually video game music. It's like musical interpretations of the video game.
It's the children's version of Pac-Man Fever, pretty much.
Huh. Okay. Well, that's interesting, but it is interesting that sort of thing goes all the way back, because I don't know, like, when I was reading up on game music and just kind of thinking about how game music has evolved over time, I mean, video games didn't start out with music. They barely started out with sound, and music sort of evolved out of the sound that video games created. It wasn't like movies, where movies were silent and then they would have a dude play music alongside the silent movie to give it some, you know, some liveliness. Like, video games, you know, had to generate their own media, not just visuals, but also the sound effects. And as, you know, the capabilities of the systems became greater, you went from, like, simple little squares that were generating basic electronic tones to where we are now, where you have basically a Hollywood score, you know, playing alongside the music and adapting dynamically to your actions and that sort of thing. But there has been this sort of, like, steady curve of progress. And, but at the same time, like, you know, early video games, even in the arcades, like Pac-Man would have jingles, but they wouldn't have music. And so having these, like, musical interpretations of something like Asteroid or Missile Command, these games that didn't have the technology sufficient to create their own music, I don't know, like... I think you can say something interesting about that, but off the top of my head, I'm not ready to commit to a thesis.
Right. Well, it is a foundation of jingles. Yeah, back then it was, like you said, and everything was very simple, just sort of very much kind of, you know, based on like early animated cartoons, you know, just like jingles and things that introduce scenes and not so much background music for you know, a few years.
I think a lot of the time they also relied on either public domain or just outright stolen, you know, ditties to get, you know, an impression in your head that you've heard this before. You know what we're trying to say. Like one of the games you guys mentioned on Retronauts a million times in the past had the Twilight Zone theme. Was it Haunted House or something? I don't know. But
yeah, that has a version of the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, I mean, thing. Obviously the illegal, Twilight, but...
Yeah, that wasn't public domain.
Yeah, I'm saying, I mean, that, I said public domain or just outright theft. So,
but I think a lot of those, like the jingles also came from the fact that they couldn't, the technology was so limited, you couldn't have music and game and audio at the same time. Like some early in television games do both, and then whenever there's gameplay audio, the music stops.
Right. Well, I mean, even on the Nintendo Entertainment System, that was the case. If you play like Mega Man 4, the NES had basically four sound channels, and... you know, when composers would get carried away and want to have three-channel music, but then have two gameplay sound effects playing simultaneously, they'd have to drop out one of the music channels. So with Mega Man 4, that really is noticeable because the music is three channels, and then there's like the sample channel where, you know, characters are running and jumping and shooting, and you're just getting like the basic gameplay sound effects. But then you also have the Mega Buster that you can charge up. And when you're charging it up, it goes. And that's a separate tone from the other sound effects. So when you charge up your Mega Buster in Mega Man 4, the actual, like, a channel of the music drops out and it becomes less interesting.
I get
not that the sound effect is drowning it out. Like, the music is literally disappearing to make way for that audio.
I get that a lot in Mario 3 because you're always running through those levels and your P meter is always at max if you're playing the right way. Well, you're playing in an efficient way, so you never hear that one channel because it's always drowned out by the little like tinkling of the P meter. That sounds gross. I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, but
was,
like
it
you
was
said,
their choice.
Like you said, Jeremy, I mean, if the composer got too overboard, then that would pretty much not sound as well. So it was really like a trick of them to figure out, you know, what would still sound good. Sound effects over music, and then you know, and make it as least noticeable as possible.
Right, and that's one of those cases where I feel like the sound team should have been working more closely with the game, you know, the programmers and the developers to say, hey, it's cool that you want this like added sound effect in here, but you know what this is going to do to the music, right? Mm-hmm. It means we have to drop out the percussion channel or something. So yeah, I mean that's sort of the compromise that video game music had to contend with. You know, for the first 10, 15 years that it existed. But if you look back and just kind of consider the evolution of audio into music and video games, I mean, obviously you'd start with Pong because Pong is kind of the game. And the sound in that game is just generated tones. It's like a burp, 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 burp. Whenever, thank you. You know, so that sort of electronic ringing tone. Whenever the ball would hit the paddles, or whenever you got an out, it would get a buzz to let you know that you'd lost a point, or the other person had gained a point. Like that was it. With Space Invaders, you kind of kept that sound, but there was this beat underlying it all that denoted the march of the invaders, and it would become faster as the gameplay advanced. But there was a sort of musicality about it because it was this steady rhythm. And the steady rhythm would change over time. And as a counterpoint to that rhythm, you had the sound effects of your ship firing into the aliens and the aliens and firing at you.
It was actually enough of a music to actually get released in Japan. There was actually a disco Space Invaders single, which I've never heard, but I desperately want to.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I was at a little cafe last night and they were playing music in the background that I could barely hear over all the people talking. But it sounded for all the world like the sound effects to Centipede, the doom to doom to doom to doom to doom to doom to. But I didn't hear any of like the, you know, the other sound effects like the flea dropping the doo and that sort of thing. But like, I don't know, it maybe it's because I was in the mindset of this episode, but it did kind of make me think about how in a lot of the early games, you didn't have music, but you had these syncopated sound effects where everything kind of came together in a sort of musical blend. And maybe it's just a natural effect of the nature of the sound effects they were using and the fact that, you know, video games are so mathematical in their programming, and music is also math. Music is, you know, like sound. It's all about the tones and the wavelengths and the waveforms and everything. And there's a science and a math to it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, in some cases it was probably deliberate. Some cases it was probably accidental. In some cases it was probably just, we played those games so much that like we hear their soundscapes in our heads and they do take on a musical quality, whether that was, you know, deliberate or not, or even actual. It's just kind of how we associate our memories of those things.
I get a kick out of the arcade games where the characters have musical shoes, like Dig Dug and Mario Brothers. Those are really cute ways of, I guess with Dig Dug, they made the music part of the game, but that was very early and it was still sort of weirdly intrusive in its own way.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, from Space Invaders, you had Pac-Man, which had a musical jingle at the beginning of each stage. But, you know, the actual sound in the course of gameplay was kind of like this background throbbing. Ms. Pac-Man spiced that up a little bit, like you'd get this kind of electronic beat when the fruit would come onto the screen. But really, it was just like the sort of doom, 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 doom. And then the sound effects over top of that. But, you know, Donkey Kong had the jingle, and then Mario's, you know, the sound effects of his feet. Yes. Kind of tied in with the very, very simple background melody. It was just like do 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 do. I mean, there was, you know, like
this, it was very, like a simple bass line or something like that.
Yeah, but Mario's movements and the jump sound effects, all of those kind of tied in with the beat. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the earliest game to actually have music. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot that happened around the same time, but I know there was a game called Snafu for the Intellivision, which is basically Snake. Competitive Snake, and it has full music in it. It starts out with like a weird sound effect that almost sounds like the ocean coming in, and then I think once it becomes, it starts, it's a four player like two computer, I mean, three computer players and one person, right? Two people and two computers or whatever. And once it becomes one-on-one, it has a full-on theme music that loops. And if the game gets too complex, it gets out of tempo and it's not weird. But it's a really good, like, as early video game music goes, it's one of the first examples and it's insanely catchy.
You know what year that was?
1980 or 81.
Hmm.
It gets very early. I think it predates Donkey Kong.
Hmm.
If it's 1980, it does for sure.
Yeah.
1981 was the date. So that's around the same time as Donkey Kong. I think, you know, everyone was just kind of getting machines that were complex and powerful enough to be able to generate music at that point. And people were starting to think, you know, maybe we should get beyond that. So I wasn't able to pin down the first video game to have like stage music or theme music. And I'm sure there were examples of jingles before Pac-Man, but that's just the first one that comes to mind. But yeah, Dig Dug was kind of like the next step beyond Donkey Kong, where Dig Dug himself, Taizo Hori, actually made the music play by walking. So
if you played
well, then that music would, you know, play steadily. But if you paused, then it would stop.
Yeah. Did Namco do that with other games, or was that just their one? I've seen that in more places than just Mario and Dig Dug, the pre-Super Mario Brothers games and Dig Dug.
I can't think of any Namco games around that time that would have done that, because most of their games around that time weren't even in that style. You had games like Galaga, you had games like Pole Position. But, you know, there was kind of either no movement or steady movement in those games.
Well, it's interesting. We're talking about technical limitations in Dig Dug. Can I just finish this?
Sorry.
In Dig Dug, the music plays when you're moving, but when you stop moving and you're killing enemies, the music stops. So it makes way for the sound effects that are, you know, alongside killing enemies. So in a way, it's working with what it can and can't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rally Axe was a Namco game. It came out around the same period of time as Pac-Man.
Right. It was
that has background music to it as well. Okay. So, yeah.
I know I thought of something like that.
Yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
It's not the same as Dig Dug. It's not that sort of progression one. But
it still has music.
Right.
Yeah. What is the theme for that like? I'm sure we could buy it on iTunes.
Make a ringtone.
Like a 99 cent loop of 15 seconds of music.
Well, in New Rally X, it's like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, everyone. I said we weren't going to karaoke.
Well, you know, the background music for
karaoke. There's a really good version of that in Pack and Jump, which is like one of 10 iPhone games I've purchased in my life.
It's in like every Namco game because it's like one of their catchier tunes.
Yeah, Namco is kind of one of the early leaders in that in that regard. Masanobu Endo, who helped design Zevius, he wasn't the composer for Zevius, was he?
I honestly don't even know. I think he did a lot of it. Yeah,
but I mean, like Zevius has
maybe
become
someone else actually coded it in or something. But
yeah, well, the for whatever reason, the music of that game has become like this part of not just Namco's personal lore, but it's actually pretty famous all throughout Japan.
Yeah.
That was actually one of the first releases on any kind of format in Japan. Mm-hmm. Like you could buy it. There was a called the. Like the hardcore, Zevius hardcore mix or something like that. And well, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but one of the guys from Yellow Magic Orchestra worked on that before he put out his first album.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's meaningful.
Yeah.
That's interesting because game music did become sort of its own thing in Japan pretty quickly. And I don't know why. I guess Yellow Magic Orchestra's popularity had something to do with it. But, you know, Kraftwerk was pretty big in the West, and they predated Yellow Magic Orchestra, and they never really, they didn't seem to make Germans say, well, das video game music is excellent.
Well, they didn't start, I mean, Yellow Magic Orchestra started their own label to release video game music
called
GMO. Gay Music Orchestra. And all those old releases you see are usually them.
Hmm.
And they existed into the mid-90s. Hmm. The last release was like a Sonic compilation.
Aww.
Yeah, I know.
Well, in Germany and, you know, sort of the rest of Europe around that time, you did have composers taking inspiration from, like, Kraftwerk and all those other guys and using it in, like, their Commodore and Amiga music and, you know, the demo scene guys.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Confusing all that in there.
But
it wasn't coming out as CDs or anything.
Yeah, it didn't feed back into mainstream culture. What you had in Japan was mainstream culture feeding into video game culture, and then video game culture music would trickle back out into the mainstream and into the musical releases.
Yeah, and that is, that's really interesting.
And I know the I've mentioned this before, but the first use of video game sound effects as music in, you know, mainstream music, such as it may have been, was in a Gentle Giant song from 1975 called Time to Kill, where they use a game of Pong to, like, set up the rhythm of the song. It's not a very good establishment of a rhythm. Like, they had done that trick before with Breaking Glass, and I know Can had done that sort of thing, obviously Pink Floyd with Money. And I think they were trying for that with Pong, with using Pong for the song, but it didn't quite work. But, you know, 1975, that was pretty cutting edge, guys.
That predates any, like, Yellow Magic Orchestra, so they're the real innovators.
Kind of, except they only did that one thing and no one paid attention to it.
What is that?
I'd like to talk about now is just the different forms of technology that creates video game music. You know, once you got to a point in game music history where there actually was game music and people wanted to create game music, then they started to explore different ways to do that. And I don't know, maybe this isn't, like, scientific, but the way I divide it up is into just, like, pure sound generation, into FM synthesis, into sampling, and into streaming. Those are really kind of the four big ways that people have created game music. And I guess FM synthesis and sound generation aren't too totally different, but they are separate and they do create different sounds and they have different values. So I don't know. I feel like they're both kind of worth talking about.
Synthesis in general. Because there were other game systems and computers that sort of had chips that were like that, use the same sort of principles.
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of cases, you would have chips that would combine combinations of...
Yeah.
That would combine different different forms of sound generation. Like the NES chip had different kinds of waves that it could generate, but it also had a sampling channel. And likewise with, you know, things like the PC 8801 and 9801 that NEC made in Japan, those were mostly FM synthesis, but they also had sampling channels. So you would get this kind of combination of things, and you don't see so much of the sound generation these days. It's more about streaming at this point,
yeah.
Because memory is it's such a commodity. It's so cheap and easy to use. But
I'm sure we'll talk about this, but I kind of slightly nostalgic in a strange way for the era of the sound card, sound blasters, and the various innovations in
and that's
PC.
Actually one of the first things I want to talk about is because. Most of the history of video game music is told through consoles and through arcade games, and people don't really focus much on the music of PCs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's in part because PCs for the longest time really didn't have innate sound generation capabilities. Like, you could get basic tones.
God, the PC,
like,
speaker
an error,
is
an error message.
But that's like the earliest game music I remember is, like, Space Quest. Mm-hmm. Like, and it had that simple, that, now I'm going to do karaoke. It's like that. Dun, 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 dun. I mean, it's plagiarized. Like, dun, 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 dun.
Right, you know? Right.
Like, very almost Star Trek, but not.
With PC speakers, well, I'm using PC speaker in the most, in the oldest sense of the term, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're not the speakers you have hooked up to your PC. It's a thing inside of your PC.
Yeah, the interior.
The thing that beeps in BIOS.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah, it's a thing that they still have that still, like, gives you the startup sound.
Whenever I play really old games, it's always funny because it feels like the sound is coming from a corner of the room instead of right in front of me, what you're used to. So, like, what is that? Is that like a doorbell playing or a phone ring? Yeah, it's always very strange.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, audio was kind of optional. Not just sound, not just music, I mean, but like sound in general with a lot of PC games. And you had to buy add-on cards. And I mean, that was one of the things that made Macintoshes so appealing back in the day and certain other computers, because they had built-in sound. But the PC clones, the, you know, built on the IBM spec and running Windows, for the longest time, they just, you know, you had to buy something separately, or they would come with a basic card and you would have to upgrade to like an Adlib card or Sound Blaster, like you mentioned. And so I don't know. I feel like it was really difficult for people making PC games to really explore the limits of their potential, because they also had to be mindful of the fact that, well, you know, people may not be playing this with good sound hardware, so we can't lean too heavily on the sound.
Yeah, well, like, developers like LucasArts were sort of making luxury experiences for people that had sound cards, because their games, more than any, at least in a few really, really stunning instances, took advantage of what then was the technology, the top of the line music technology in PCs.
Mm-hmm.
Like with Monkey Island 2, I've written about this 3 million times, so please look it up. But there's a town in the game where it plays one main theme, and as you visit different areas, it transitions into the various variations of the scene based on what characters you're talking to. So this is something they only did once because, according to Ron Gilbert, no one noticed or cared, so they didn't put as much work into it. But it's sort of like a set piece for what music technology could have been if they had pursued it.
And people borrow that idea liberally through the years. I mean, the first I really noticed it in console games was Skies of Arcadia, when you're flying around the world map and there's a, you know, the world map theme, but then depending on which continent you're flying over, the music becomes more like triumphant for the Imperials, or more like jungle with a rhythm for the South America area.
Right.
And that's like one of the driving principles for Koji Kondo, was like, you know, making sure that music shifts when you do certain things.
And like having, like what you said with Monkey Island, that's something like, once they got to the really early streaming audio, you couldn't do that.
Right.
Because you'd have to switch tracks on a disc.
But I did want to stress that it wasn't just removing and adding instruments based on who you're talking to. It would rewrite a transition up to the next part of the song based on where it was in the current version of the song. So it knew how to gently transition into something, like put those notes in the right order.
Yeah, that
so it didn't
cool.
sound
yeah,
awful.
Yeah, I mean, that's really impressive. Because like Skies of Arcadia, which came 10 years later, longer, that didn't really make a gentle transition. It would just like fade in the drum loop, fade out the drum loop, and then kind of the Asiatic sounds would come in.
Yeah, that is really cool. And I wish it would have took off, like be more of a standard thing in sound design.
But yeah, I think probably because people, like a lot of people playing that game, probably didn't have the technology for it.
So exactly.
It wasn't even that they didn't notice it if they heard it. It was that they couldn't hear it.
And even if they did notice it, it's not the kind of thing that's going to move games.
Yeah, exactly. It's like dynamic music, who cares?
Yeah. Right.
We'd think it's awesome and nobody else would.
And you know, that's why people who own Commodore 64s love the music so much, because the C64 had a built-in chip called the SID chip that was a very complex piece. It was supposed to actually, I was reading about it, it was supposed to have, according to the original plan, 32 different voices that it could generate simultaneously. And like, it didn't work out that way, because I'm sure that would have been exorbitantly expensive. And it ended up with 3 different voices. But those voices had a lot of capacity. They had a lot of capability for creating sound. And, you know, because of the sort of the cleverness of the people who were programming for that very limited system and trying to get the most out of it, they started to discover all kinds of things you could do with the audio decay, and the way you could create like these really, really elaborate oscillating tones and things like that.
Yeah.
And it created this really unique sound. You can always tell a C64 game or someone who's kind of riffing on the C64 sound, because it has that sort of like crazy oscillation, and there's just like these nutty arpeggios.
That or any NES game made in Europe as well.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I didn't really hear that on a lot of European NES games at the time. Like, Rare made a lot of developed a lot of NES games, and I didn't really notice that, but I have noticed Rare people going back and doing like NES, you know, working with the NES chip or NES samples, and they started to sort of incorporate that sound as like afterwards. So it creates a sound that to me isn't even really authentic to the NES.
No.
But it's even though it's using the NES technology, it's more like a C64 style.
Who made the Silver Surfer for the NES? That has a crazy,
I think that was Rare,
C64 style soundtrack. You should plug that in here because it's amazing. I don't know if it was Rare, but I know it was like Tim Fallon.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, who got his start on C64? So
yeah, it's like, how did he make the NES do that? It's magic.
Is that good?
I didn't have a C64 growing up, so I was never really exposed to those games. But like a few years ago, they released a compilation on CD of the music, and I bought it. And I was surprised at how different it sounds. Like they're saying, this nothing sounds like that music. The way the decay and the arpeggios, it's still like you can tell it's that era. But it doesn't. The Nintendo couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not even that it's better or worse. It's just entirely different.
It has a whole. It has a completely different texture to it.
Yeah, I would say. It's very unique.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was made by Software Creations,
okay,
who also developed for NES Solstice, Wolverine, and Altered Space.
Well, Silver Surfer was garbage as a game, but the soundtrack is worth looking up independently.
And they also developed the Amiga and actually basically the European PC versions of Bionic Commando.
Oh, wow.
And
I know
they
those
totally changed up the Bionic Commando soundtrack.
I didn't know that those even exist.
What's that?
The PC. I never even heard of those versions of those games.
They're based on the arcade version.
Oh, okay.
And they use like kind of the Capcom tunes, but they just like it's crazy.
Wow. Same with Ghouls and Ghosts.
I remember listening to the Bionic Commando soundtrack for like the SID chip version. I was like, this is going to be cool. And listening and just being like, what did they do? But I mean, they totally took it in their own direction and kind of owned it themselves, which is cool. I mean, it's really great that they were able to do that.
Yeah.
It created a sort of stamp of like, hey, we were here, we did this. Yeah. And, you know,
Capcom,
as a result, they have.
Didn't care.
Yeah. When do they ever? But as a result, they have a really dedicated fan base.
Right. Yeah.
If we're going to talk about sound generation and FM synthesis being roughly the same thing, I guess we can pull together a lot of the things, you know, a lot of the systems that use those technologies. Arcade games in the late 80s were really big into FM synthesis. They all have the, like, especially Capcom's games, they all have this very distinct sort of clear sound that then, you know, you would hear in Genesis games a few years later. Whereas, you know, other systems like the NES, again, had its kind of distinct combination of square and triangle waves with a sampling channel. And the combinations of devices that or technologies that people used for the machines they created helped sort of define those machines and create unique sounds. And, the NES, I think, had a great legacy because the different sounds it could create were separate from one another. And so you were able, you know, a good composer was able to combine the different sound styles that it could generate to create, you know, really, really great music. Like, obviously, it's being played by a computer, and it's very simple. There's only so many channels. But, like, there's the room for melody and counter-melody and interesting beats. And, you know, depending on how adventurous they wanted to get, the sampling channels could do crazy things. Like, Super Mario Brothers 3 sounds like it has steel drums in it.
Right, yeah.
I love those.
Yeah.
Those like, I remember hearing that and being like, I can't believe I'm hearing this. This is crazy. Yeah. It's like Calypso.
Also, all of those Konami soundtracks from that era are just great. Even if they're for trash games, they always have really good soundtracks.
Yep.
Just those Konami drums are so, they're perfect. Yep. I love them so much. Yeah.
And the NES era is also like the era where everything has arpeggios.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like every game has an awesome fake guitar solo.
Right. Final Fantasy. Because, I mean, they had to use things like arpeggios to sort of fake depth for the music, because you only had like three voices that you could use, or you know, if you had your own custom chip, then you could have an extra voice. But we didn't really get those in America. We got kind of like the standard format, and then things like disc system games had to be converted over and simplified so that they could fit into the fewer sound channels.
Or the Japanese version of Contra has, you know, the extra chip in it that has better music.
Yeah, Konami, Sunsoft, Namco, and a few other publishers in Japan were able to produce their own chips, and Konami's definitely went the furthest. They actually, their VRC7 chip, which was used for Lagrange Point and one other game, I can't remember what, had an FM synthesizer inside of the chip.
Yeah.
So not only, you know, like the VRC6 that was used in Castlevania 3 in Japan had six audio channels instead of four, but the VRC7 had those sound channels plus an FM synthesis channel. Yeah. So it sounds like nothing else on the NES. It's amazing.
It's like a step down from the Genesis.
Right.
Pretty much.
Did those chips increase the prices of those games significantly? I wasn't ever sure if that was
everything was overpriced back then.
Well, yeah, that was in the boom era of Japan. Like,
yeah,
the bubble economy. So everything was just crazy expensive anyway. Yeah.
If
you go back and look at Super Famicom games, they have the price listed on the boxes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know, Chrono Trigger is 11,000 yen, which is you know, right now that converts to $110 at the time. I don't know the exact conversion, but it was more than 100.
Yeah, I remember looking at Chips and Bits or whatever, those ads in the back of magazines, and new Japanese games were $150 routinely. So, man.
And if it didn't increase the price, then it would decrease the profit margins. So either way, they wouldn't want to do it.
Right. I just kind of wanted to draw a comparison between that and sort of the luxury experience you'd get with a LucasArts PC game, where you're paying more for something that most people aren't going to recognize or pay attention to.
Right. I think for a lot of people, I don't know, maybe it's different now because people are so cheap about buying games. But I think at the time, it was maybe easier to justify paying a little bit more for a game. Because games did have more variable pricing, like a, you know, kind of a basic game would be $30 or $40 on NES. And then there would be sort of the high end games, like the really highly anticipated ones, or things like an RPG or something where the ROM size was larger and they had built in batteries. And those could range up to $60. So, you know, there was more flexibility in the pricing. And, you know, to get that premium experience, it was easier to pay an extra $10, $20 here, as opposed to paying, you know, an extra $200, $300 one time for the PC upgrade card.
Towards the end with like Tales of Phantasia and Star Ocean, they're like, we put a whole song in this, and God knows how much memory that ate up, but I know it was compressed to hell and back, but still.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of like whole scale sampling is interesting, because the arcade games were doing that back in the 80s. You had people try to integrate music with things like Journey Escape, where wasn't actually built into the chip itself. It wasn't part of the game data. They had a cassette tape that just played a loop of Journey music. And then there was like, you know, PC-generated ditties, jingles at the beginning and end of stages. But then a few years later, you had Psycho Soldier by SNK, which actually had a theme song that played at the title screen. Psycho Soldier!
Psycho power を起こす
Or maybe throughout the first stage. I can't remember. It's been a while.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
But I know I've spliced that into a Retronauts episode before, but it's great. It's not just like music. It's actually a girl singing, and it's so compressed. You can barely understand what she's saying.
She's on CB radio or something.
Something about magic, and she's a little girl with powers.
That's
a
crazy
inside.
Like, they translated it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's an English version, too.
Where's the Japanese? Sounds a little bit better in Japanese. To sound like a nerd.
But, you know, like, people were really pushing the limits as much as they could.
Right.
And there was more flexibility for that sort of thing in the arcade because it wasn't tied to a specific console. It was, you know, case-by-case device. So if someone wanted to create a machine that could sing a song, they could custom design a chipset that had space, you know, memory space given over just to play a song.
Yeah.
Or, you know, play a laser disc or something.
Well, I was at the Classic Gaming Expo last year, and I wish I remembered the technical details behind this, but the creator of Qbert was there, and he was explaining how basically he made Qbert spout nonsense, and the whole thing about the actual physical property thing, whatever, in the arcade cabinet that would make the thud when Qbert would die.
The knocker, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess figuring out how to make a character like just speak garbled nonsense was a huge challenge. And is Qbert like 83?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, okay, yeah. Right around there.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Gottlieb?
Speaking of like separate things, though, I mean, like the ColecoVision got a voice module.
Yep.
For that.
So did the TI-99/4A.
Yeah, right. I mean, that voice that sort of thing
module, right?
Those cropped up a bit back then as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of immortalized in war games. I mean, the Whopper basically spoke with a TI or Intellivision voice module. Would you like to play a game?
Yeah.
And that's still how Stephen Hawking talks.
I know, even Roger Ebert got an upgrade before he died. I wonder what's the deal. Maybe he just likes robot voice.
I don't know.
Stephen Hawking's retro, I guess.
Yeah.
Old school.
Well, I mean, I would assume that he just feels that's his voice now.
Yes.
I guess
he said as much.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, he was probably kind of on the cutting edge of this sound generation technology at the time.
Yeah.
And that's how people associate him now. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, he does guest appearances with that computer voice. So it makes sense.
So the sort of innate sound generation technology kind of phased out. I mean, what was the last system that really used like sound generation as its basic audio style? Like the Game Boy launched in 1989, and it had a Z80 processor. And
do you want to say like GBA that era?
But GBA used a lot of samples.
Okay, well, it actually used even 8-bit Game Boy sound because it was backwards compatible. A lot of GBA games use 8-bit. Game Boy tones.
Really? Because when I'm thinking of the GBA games that I played, all of those pretty much had like really, really badly sampled sound.
Harmony of Dissonance had an 8-bit soundtrack, didn't it? Or an 8-bit. It felt like very low tech compared to other games I was playing at the time.
Yeah,
that as well.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right, Jeremy, but I think also just like the main Game Boy Advance sound chip was not that great. And so a lot of stuff sounded like it was sampled.
Yeah, like Final Fantasy VI soundtrack.
Well, no, that's the thing is that the Super Famicom, the Super NES, used a special chip that Sony developed for them that was pretty much entirely sample based. Like the innate Super NES sound it wasn't like electronically generated so much as played back. And that's why pretty much, you know, there's like certain sounds that you associate with the NES. Like a ton of games have that slap bass sound effect that was built into the sound libraries. It didn't have, you know, like PCM drums and things like that. You had samples of drums, and then, you know, people could make games where they sampled in their own sounds. And so you got like, you know, Final Fantasy VI.
Yes.
I just know the one telling feature of the GBA sound chip is just this omnipresent hiss that you always hear.
Well, that's the sampling.
Yeah.
That's like static, you know, coming as a result of the low audio sample.
It's the worst.
Right. And that's why you had games like the Final Fantasy games that sounded really flat and off and weird because they didn't have that Super NES audio chip to run on. Even though the GBA was pretty much a portable Super NES, it didn't have Sony's audio chip for probably obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And so they had to kind of do their best. And so they would like sample music. And then, you know, because the cartridges were really small, they weren't that much larger really than Super NES cartridges in terms of capacity.
Yeah.
They couldn't get really accurate samples. So everything just like all the Super NES conversions sounded really flat as a result of that. And I don't know, Ray, I guess you're right. There was like, you know, audio tones built into the system, but
yeah.
I feel like most of the games I played didn't use that. And then when you had something like Harmony of Dissonance, where they actually did, everyone said, this is the worst thing.
Yeah. People complain about that.
Well, because the game that came before, the Castlevania game that came before it, Circle of the Moon, everything was sampled.
Right, right.
Like the soundtrack was entirely sampled. Yeah, but like that was kind of where they put a lot of the data of the game into that soundtrack.
We probably just weren't far away enough from NES music to appreciate it for what it was. I guess on a national, on a cultural level. I mean, yeah, we were as dorks,
yes,
but
yes, yes.
Well, and then, you know, you could also make the case that Harmony of Dissonance's music wasn't actually that good.
That too. I think people were just complaining about the quality rather than the compositions, technical quality rather.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I feel like there was an art to composing good chiptune music.
Oh, definitely.
And during the GBA era, I think the people who were kind of working in the business doing that music maybe had forgotten those things or had never really had experience with doing those things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they hadn't ridden the bike for a while and they forgot how not to fall off. If that makes sense.
Yeah,
that's my exactly. that's my speculation.
Yeah. Sure,
but it's kind of like, you know, even so, you see a lot of games these days that harken back to classic game styles, and that sort of kind of came into vogue, you know, 7, 8, 9 years ago. People started, you know, big publishers started looking back and saying, "Oh, let's make some old games," you know, like new games that are in that old game style. And it took them a while to get up to speed, which is why you had Nintendo creates new Super Mario Brothers, which wasn't actually that good a Mario game. Like, if you compare it to the older Mario games, it was kind of rough, kind of shoddy.
Yeah.
But, you know, each subsequent new Super Mario Brothers game has gotten better as they've kind of remembered, oh, that's how we do this. I think...
yeah.
Do you disagree?
No, you're
okay.
Right here.
I feel like doing anything in sort of that old style, like, let's deliberately limit ourselves instead of pushing the limits. It takes finesse. And a lot of what made good old game music so great was that it was these composers who were like, I want to express myself, and these are the extreme limitations I'm working in, so I'm going to push it as hard as I can. And, you know, it takes a certain discipline, certain mindset to do that. And as you get used to dealing with samples and with streaming audio, you know, maybe you kind of lose that edge.
And it's funny if you listen to some of the old, like, game soundtrack releases that have, like, there's a few I have that have the original music, and then they'll, instead of having like a orchestral something, they'll have like it redone on a Fairlight or a synthesizer from the era.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so used to working in the limitations of the game hardware that the better version, I used air quotes there, I don't know why, doesn't sound much different because they're trying to recreate the version that was on, you know, the MSX.
Right. So you're talking about like EaseBook 1 and 2 or something like
EaseBook 1 and 2, that there's a game called, I think it's DeAngelis or Angelus, never came out in America. The music's by the person who did the Dragon's Quest music.
Mm-hmm.
And it has like two or three different versions of the music on it, and they sound very similar because they just didn't think to really experiment with the other hardware they had.
Yeah.
I think they were so used to working with limitations.
Then, on the other hand, you have, like, recently there was the Sonic the Hedgehog anniversary soundtrack, and part of that had the quote-unquote demo versions of the music, which was done on, like, the original synthesizers. So, and...
Yeah, and you have Yuzo Koshiro, his work for the Etrian Odyssey games, he composes on a PC 9801. He, like, that is how he creates his music, or it's actually not on the hardware itself, but it's in a like a system that is very accurate to that sound.
Yeah, it must be like a sampling suite. Not sampling, but I mean, yeah. It must have something that is accurately reproducing that.
Yeah, and so he creates that sound, and then it's converted over to whatever the DS can handle. But the Etrian Odyssey soundtracks arrive, and they have like the original like Core DS sound, like what you get in the retail game.
Right.
And then you get the FM synthesized PC 9801 version that sounds so rich and so good. It's really great because Etrian Odyssey Untold has, you know, it's the remake of the original Etrian Odyssey. It has like a lush Etrian Odyssey 4 style version of the soundtrack, but you can also play the original version. And it's not the DS audio. It is actually the FM synthesized version. Really good.
Yeah.
Really good. But he's very unusual. Like most people don't work like him.
Well, that's also how he made his name.
Right. Know? Yeah, but I mean, that's just like the instrument or the style he prefers to work with. And as a result, like he kind of maintains this certain style, even when he's working in different formats and different genres. You can still kind of tell it's his music because it has that sort of 1990s discipline to it. Like, how do I get the most out of a limited sort of sound? And so everything tends to be more aggressive and sort of push harder. He did some compositions for Castlevania Portrait of Ruin alongside Michiru Yamane, and his pieces stand apart from hers because hers tend to be more kind of that like Baroque Gothic orchestration, and his tend to be more like aggressive rock style, like classic synthesized video game rock.
Yeah, not bad. Talking about him, I mean, also like jumping back to the Super NES, he did, you know, he really expanded and really took hold of that sound system in the Super NES.
Oh God, yes, from the beginning too.
Yeah,
yeah, it's interesting because sometimes you have these new technologies come out, and the people who play around with it in the beginning actually do the most with it. Like we talked about Castlevania Circle of the Moon, it might have the best sounding Game Boy Advance soundtrack. And I think that's just because the composers and programmers were like, wow, let's just go hog wild with this. So they made a game that looked pretty, you know, Sega Genesis quality, but sounded more Super NES quality. And I'm sorry, fans of the Genesis. I'm just saying
you're not wrong.
The Genesis had a flatter, simpler, less colorful visual style.
Yeah.
But I mean, like if you compare that Castlevania game to the later ones on Game Boy Advance, it definitely looks the plainest and most, you know, you can tell it's kind of like an early 32-bit handheld game as opposed to one of the later ones.
Yeah,
but it sounds great.
There are really good Genesis soundtracks, but I was always impressed by developers who were able to make soundtracks that didn't sound like they were on the Genesis, like Shining Force. Those games, there's a little bit of tinniness to the instrument quality, but it kind of has a Super NES style to it. I mean, obviously not of the same richness or depth or texture, but it feels like they're trying to get away from their technological constraints with that one, those games.
I know I've talked about this before, but the Sega Genesis has always sounded like the future to me, like a really like a really dark, bleak Blade Runner future.
Yeah,
it's like Vangelis did the soundtrack for every Genesis game, and it's just very gloomy and oppressive. Even when it tries to be upbeat, that synthesized sound is so harsh and so electronic.
Right.
And I like that about it, but it's not appropriate for everything.
I mean,
it's hard to do like gentle music with FM synthesis.
Even as like I was like 11 or 12 when did Genesis come out?
1988 in Japan, 1989 here.
Okay, well then I was 10. And even back then I thought it sounded like garbage. Once the Super Nintendo came out, I couldn't go.
It was hard.
If
you're used to that.
I just did not like I was a burgeoning music geek back then, and just the tone of it and the fidelity of it. And once you started to get games that were on both systems,
It was kind of like a robot mouth harp, you know?
Yeah.
That's the instrument I think and the Genesis used.
I think in certain situations it would be better. I remember there was a game that was probably, if I played it now, it would be horrible, called, I think it was called Technocop.
Yes,
which had awesome music in it, because it was just that like, you was, oh, I'm sorry, like you were saying, like, music of the future sounding, like this really dark and oppressive, but if they were trying to make anything that had any kind of range to it, I think it just got stuck in that area.
Yeah. Technocop.
Yeah, I'll go to bat for the Sega Genesis and say that where its sound capabilities excelled were in creating like really sharp, driving, percussive, cutting music. It was great for action games. It was great for shooters.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Super NES definitely had more range and more versatility because of its underlying capabilities of the sound chip. But at the same time, everything on Super NES tended to sound muddier, a little muted.
Yeah.
There was kind of like the softness to it. And that's actually also the visual style, because the Super NES had a broader color palette. People tended to go more for like these sort of soft pastels. So the Genesis always, like, it kind of fit the marketing. Like, Genesis was marketed as this more aggressive, more in-your-face machine, and that actually characterized the visual design and the audio design of the system, whereas the Super NES was softer and gentler and maybe richer and deeper, but, you know, if you're 13 years old and you just want to like play it loud, then maybe you won't go to the Super NES to play it loud. Maybe you'll play it loud on Genesis.
I mean, my two favorite game soundtracks of all time are Revenge of Shinobi and Streets of Rage 2, so I'm not gonna say that those aren't great, you know.
But those are fantastic action games. And Kushiro do both of those? Did he? Okay. Yeah, I know he did Streets of Rage.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I mean, that dude can do stuff with FM synthesis that is just stunning. He can make good, gentle FM synthesis music.
And
like his Etrian Odyssey exploration themes are very pastoral and like very soothing. And they're, you know, using FM synthesis and a little bit of sampling.
And the Shinobi, Revenge of Shinobi has the best fake steel drums of any video game ever.
Yeah.
Even better than the Star Road stages of Super Mario Brothers. When you're on the Star Road and you let it sit for like 30 seconds, then it starts playing the steel drum version of the Mario theme. Better than that.
That's stiff competition.
Yeah. I think it is. You know, one of them's like hardcore, like, I'm going to kill some ninjas with throwing stars, steel drums. And the other's like, let's chill out and look at some, you know, mushrooms.
Are we just jumping around? I'm not sure what era we're in.
We're just jumping around.
There's one thing I did want to bring up, and that is the how so many characters all of a sudden had to have voices that didn't have voices before. I mean,
thank you!
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they kind of cribbed that from the cartoon series, because Toad did sound a lot like that. I mean, I'm sure they didn't even know about it, but somebody had to clue them into that, because Toad, I don't know, it feels like, that's not the first voice I think of when I think of Toad. If I didn't see the cartoon series, you know.
Yeah. Right.
But it was weird because, like, I don't know, how did you guys feel about, you know, hearing Mario for the first time, hearing Sonic for the first time? And there was, like, there were huge debates at the time, like, Guybrush Threepwood shouldn't sound like this. You know, it was this character who had been silent for a decade. So now there are new controversies emerging, you know, in having these characters talk to you for the first time. And I think Nintendo was smart in keeping Link just like a grunty guy, you know. He never has said much, and I hope he really doesn't. And I feel like it would be a mistake if he did. But Mario and Luigi and everybody, I think with Mario Kart 64, that was like, this is what all of their voices sound like from now on. And Nintendo was doing that
Mario
behind the scenes.
Mario 64 was the first to have Mario voiced.
Right.
And actually, like, he wasn't voiced in Japan, was he?
Was he?
The original Japanese release of Mario 64 didn't have
voices. It didn't have Peach's voice.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But, I mean, Mario, his voice emerged in video game form, Mario 64, but Mario Kart 64, I think they assigned everyone a voice and, like, a personality based on that voice, if they didn't have one before.
And for the most part, I thought those were fine. I mean, considering the voices Mario had been given before that, it could have been so much worse.
Right.
But sort of like a goofy, happy-go-lucky Italian guy, that's fine. As opposed to like Captain Lou Albano or Bob Hoskins.
Nameless Canadian voice actor.
Yeah.
Who I liked. I liked the second cartoon series, Mario.
Yeah, he wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It's just weird that they went super falsetto. I would have never seen that coming.
Oh my God. You should play Mario Teaches Typing because that guy is like even rougher, more towards the Albano.
So. Hey, kids. We're going to type today.
Actually, no. It's like, oh, I can't remember. I guess I'll have to find a sample. Welcome to Mario Teaches Typing. So it's like a guy trying to do Charles Martin.
Oh, I see.
What's great is, this is slightly related, but how they approximate Mario and Luigi's speech in the Mario RPG. Mm-hmm. Do they still do that in the 3DS version? It feels slightly culturally insensitive, but what are the Italians going to do to us, right? I think once you win a war against somebody, we can make fun of...
Yeah, I think every representation of Mario and Luigi are slightly culturally insensitive, if you want to think about it.
But it is funny.
I just don't.
It's not that bad.
It's very playful,
like a
babbling
sound. It's not like ching-chong-wing-wong or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would be bad.
I think it's technically...
There are levels of offensiveness.
Right. But I think it's technically the Italians are just other white people now, so it's okay to make fun of them.
they're swarthier white people than most.
Yeah, yeah, they have bushier mustaches, but, you know, I just think that that's a funny shortcut to, we don't want to characterize these everymen too much, so we're just going to disguise their language.
Hmm.
I suppose so, yeah. At least you don't see them, you know, running around carrying spaghetti or anything.
Yeah.
That was all back in the cartoon.
Right. Yeah, the cartoon really fixated on the pasta power and all that stuff.
Yeah. And not canon.
It's better than having them talk the entire time, too.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Oh, like in Super Mario Advance?
Never played it.
Yeah. I never have finished one of those because everyone's so annoying.
Yeah.
Even the Yoshi's Island, they took away the cute little vacuum cleaner sound and made Yoshi that stupid baby from Yoshi's Story.
But I thought they retconned Yoshi's voice. Now he's back to weird sound effects again. I know
that not in Yoshi's Island.
Well, that was
for 3DS.
Four, five. Oh shit!
The new one. The new one. He's got Babble Baby.
I refuse to acknowledge that game exists.
Yeah, it's not so good. So we kind of talked about the synthesis side of things, and we've talked about sampling and how it was sort of folded in. But I mean, there's actually, you know, even beyond what we've talked about, sampling has become more and more integral to video games. You had things like the song in Psycho Soldier, but again, the NES had a sampling channel, and for the most part, that was not used to create like lifelike sounds. It was just like tiny little clips, but they would use that for the percussion channel very, very frequently, or like a sound effects channel, instead of creating that sort of like staticky video game sound effect.
The old noise channel.
Yeah. They would use the sampling to create more convincing explosions or deeper drum sounds or something like that. I'm sure Konami's unique drum sound came from the fact that they had like, you know, in-house samples that they used and just kind of spread across their games.
Yeah, no doubt.
Wasn't the Legend of Zelda have sampling? I have a feeling it did. I feel like it had some sort of primitive sampling. They were doing it that long ago.
All the sound effects that I can think of in Zelda, for the most part, they have that kind of clear electronic sound that you get from generated music.
The little Link grunt. I don't know where that comes from.
The boop.
Yeah. It's probably much clearer in the FDS version, but I need to do a comparison.
I think that his voice actually was like sampled. You know, the sound effects, a lot of them were sampled in the Famicom Disk System version, or they used that unique channel. Because a lot of the sound effects were changed for the American version. I think the sword sound effect, the shrieks of the monsters.
That's right. Yeah, those monster shrieks have to be sampled in some way.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I really can't say. Like, I don't want to pretend I know about
it. I was just wondering how far back this goes, if they had it figured out from the beginning, or was it more of a, you know, as we go through the 80s, this technology is...
Yeah, this is something I haven't really been able to find a lot of information about. I know that, like, you can tell in a lot of later games where they start to use sampling a lot. But yeah, I really I don't know what the original plan there was. You know, they put a lot of capabilities into the NES, the Famicom, that they didn't really know what to do with at the time.
Right.
But they were like, this will be good for the future, and then, you know, people figured out stuff to do with it. But, you know, even with the NES, you had that port on the bottom of the system that no one ever did anything with. So, you know, sometimes they future-proof things, and sometimes that, the future-proofing ends up being completely pointless.
That's where you hide your weed.
Oh, okay.
That's an unadvertised feature on the box. That's not on the box,
rather.
I think
my neighbors use that a lot. Bob, you're not going to talk about Earthbound?
Oh, that's right. Well, I believe Earthbound, it was supposed to be a much smaller game memory capacity-wise, but I believe 8 megabits are out of 24 are devoted to holding all the music, which are all these crazy samples. And I mean, as much as you think you appreciate Earthbound now, download it on a Wii U and play it over a modern stereo, and there's like the channel separation, the way things fade back and forth. You can really hear those samples before, if you're playing on like on a tiny little TV with a dingy little speaker, mm-hmm. you weren't going to notice. But presented digitally, it's just even more apparent.
Whose voice is sampled in the game? When you choose your character,
that's Itoi.
Okay, Deska.
Yeah, that's Itoi.
That's Itoi?
Okay. He also says, "I miss you" in the end when the credits play.
Oh, that's right.
But yeah, like even, I mean, I think he's even credited. He whoever did the belch is credited. I mean, not just sound effects, but obviously he got in a lot of trouble for sampling straight up parts of songs, chunks of songs, and rearranging them. And at that point in America, all the rules had been written about sampling. I believe it came out of the late 80s. I don't know a lot about it. Maybe, yeah, can you talk about sampling laws and when they took effect? I know Paul's Boutique
co-host
was the last major record that got out.
There was a few small ones, but the biggest one was Bismarcky sampled the Escape, the Pina Colada song. It was on the album that has Just a Friend. He lost. And after that, it became much harder. 2 Live Crew was sued, you know, for everything.
They were also
sued for using Pretty Woman. But they won their lawsuit because it was for a song called Ugly Woman.
Right.
Which is a classy tune. And they were able to argue it was parody, like Weird Al.
Right.
And if it's parody, it's okay, but if it's not, it isn't. And nowadays, it's practically impossible. You have to sample something to the point of it being unrecognizable. And even then, if they find out, even if it's like one note, it's nearly impossible. But like, yeah I know I haven't played Earthbound in like since the Super Nintendo, but I know it has all those
right there's
like, Beatles references and
like for Dungeon Man what's his name, Tanaka, and there was another guy too who doesn't get as much credit.
Suzuki, who was also, he's been in a ton of
Moonriders, is that the name
Moonriders, and he was also in the Beatniks with Yukihiro Takahashi from the Metsu Orchestra.
Okay, awesome.
It all, you can trace almost everything back to them.
Well, the Earthbound soundtrack, as much as Earthbound is a reflection of American culture, the soundtrack is a reflection of how much they love American, not just American, but just like Western. Rock music, Western music. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, the Dungeon, like, this is just a few samples. If you go to like Earthbound Central, which is done by a guy named Tomato, he has an entire article about here's where all these samples come from. Yeah. Here's where you can find them in the game. And that was before we thought it would ever come out again digitally, but I guess it did. But like Dungeon Man, there's like a drum loop from the Beatles. Because obviously someone liked the drum, how the drum sounded in a song. I forget what song it even is. The music for Moonside, it's less playful. It's straight up, I like how this Rick Ocasek song sounds. I'm going to steal the intro and loop it and do weird stuff with it. Stuff like that. And even, where is the French anthem that's in a Beatles song? Can't Buy Me Love.
I honestly have not played Earthbound since it came out.
Well, I mean, that is stolen. They could have used any other version of that, but they took that version out of a Beatles song and mixed it up and did weird stuff with it. So,
are they actually sampling it or just like remaking it?
Oh, they're sampling.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
that's the difference.
Whatever they did with it, whatever they did at the time, but these are straight up samples. And that's why Earthbound's soundtrack is just so strange and amazing.
Yeah.
And nothing is like it. I mean, nothing back then, especially.
True. Yeah, when I interviewed Hip Tanaka a few years ago, I asked a little bit about Mother 2's soundtrack, Earthbound soundtrack, and he was like, I don't want to talk too much about this because there's problems.
And as much as we talk about Earthbound too much on this podcast, I want to know what had to happen behind the scenes, you know, to make this re-release possible, because I've been playing it, nothing has changed, you know?
I'm willing to bet nobody told anybody.
Probably it.
And, you know, everyone involved who sampled probably has either bigger fish to fry or they just don't, like, don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah,
a lot of that I don't know what the law is in Japan, but a lot of like the, or like, who's an example? go back to Paul's, one of you mentioned Paul's Boutique.
Right.
Like, if somebody wanted to, they could like, what's that? That mountain that have Mississippi Queen?
That sampled
in Paul's Boutique. If they really wanted to, they could sue Beastie Boys and win.
Yeah.
I mean, the Knack tried that with My Sorona and Run DMC's is Tricky. And one of them died before it went ahead, so they dropped the lawsuit.
Oh, okay.
But, like, there's no cutoff point. There's a cutoff point in, like, labels knowing they can't get away with it. But there's no cutoff point in, like, you know...
Yeah, copyright now is basically indefinite.
Yeah.
I mean, Nile Rodgers sued the Sugar Hill Gang. He didn't sue him, but he made an agreement with them to get money for Rapper's Delight because it samples Good Times.
Mm.
And Afrika Mabata and Kraftwerk had to work something out for the song he used Transship Express for.
So Nintendo's probably like, Paul McCartney doesn't know about Earthbound. He's not going to play it long enough to hear a sample from a song you recorded 40 years ago.
Yeah.
You know,
don't ask, that's don't buried. Tell.
Exactly. Yeah. Except that we're telling, oh my God, what if Paul McCartney's a listener? That's far-fetched.
No, it's very likely.
Hi, Paul.
Don't take Earthbound away from us.
He's actually a fan of Earthbound.
Oh, I would hope so.
Who isn't?
I was going to say, there's a recent sort of controversy about the guy who did almost all the music for the Dragon Ball Z games, the recent ones, like the Budokai games. Mm. He had pretty much ripped off, like, I think he did, like, remake or something, this Swedish sort of electronica guy. And for the recent HD re-releases of the Budokai games, like, all the music was replaced.
Oh,
like,
wow.
That guy pretty much got shamed out of the
business.
Were
these Japanese-developed games?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's interesting, because usually you can get away with whipping off. Like, it's hard to prove that. Like, I remember, like, I mean, you talk to any music snob long enough, and they'll be like, well, that song sounds like this song. And, you know,
I think it just became so obvious that he was just, like, shunned.
I wonder if it was him just being enthusiastic, or was it just straight up, I don't feel like making my own music?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's weird, because I feel like there are cultural differences in how people approach intellectual property. And I think Japan is much more of like a remix culture, because they don't have the same...
Yeah, property laws in Japan are much looser.
Yeah.
Which is one of the big things in Mighty No. 9's favor right now.
Yes.
He's not Mega Man, he's Super
Guy. He's not Mega Man. He's reminiscent of a character you may remember from games that I worked on sometime in the past.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's stuff like that.
So the last big kind of aspect of music and video games is streaming technology. And that's something that, has been around for quite a while. I talked about Psycho Soldier, and that was somewhere between a stream and a sample. Dragon's Lair, had a Laserdisc, and all those Laserdisc games technically used streaming audio and video.
How about that Journey tape?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There you go.
Analog streaming.
But really, streaming became much more prevalent with the rise of CD-ROMs and the addition of, the PC Engine Duo, Turbo CD. Is that what it's called in America?
TurboGrafx CD.
Sega CD, PCs that had CD-ROM drives that they could play games off of. Suddenly something called Redbook Audio became a big part of that. And Redbook Audio is simply...
CD music
that the game is like it queues up and plays it straight off the disc, which basically frees the game to focus its attention on other things and not have to generate music internally. Like, it can just say, hey, CD drive, play some music now.
Yeah.
and that was pretty popular throughout the 90s, but kind of steadily fell out of favor. Eventually CDs went away, but also because it is much more limited. I mean, it has to queue up the music.
Right.
And if there's a change, right. If there's a change, then, the music has to stop and it has to queue up a different track. So it's very disruptive. And that was maybe not as noticeable back in the game, days of games having huge load times. But eventually it started to become a disadvantage. And so people started using something called Yellowbook streaming, which was basically Redbook audio, except that instead of being... the music being denoted as just a plain old CD audio track that you could play in a CD player, it was kind of internally housed, and it could be accessed more quickly. It was just part of the game code.
And you couldn't put it in your CD player and listen to it.
Right, exactly.
I think that had a big thing to do with it, especially.
This is a PlayStation disc.
Yes. I have a disc. They did that up to the Dreamcast. They would put those warnings in, and I have one that's in like 8 languages.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so if you want to know how to not put a Dreamcast disc in German, it can tell you how to do it, like Mickey's Magical Racing or something. But my favorite, I love finding old Sega CD games and putting them in and hoping to have a book audio in them and ripping them. Mm-hmm. I found one, like, you know, the music's always great. Like, that's how you can get the Sonic CD soundtrack. The whole soundtrack's on that disc.
Yes.
Virtua Fighter.
I think I did that with Panic, the game Panic.
Yeah. Yes.
But that is really good music.
The really funny ones are the ones that put the sound effects on there. Like, so Tomb Raider, all the audio, for some reason, in the cutscenes is red book audio.
Oh, isn't Lunar the same way?
I never found a copy of that. My personal favorite is all the announcer audio in Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 is red book audio.
Oh,
wow. So if you want to...
Oh, geez. Cue up track 5000.
Yeah.
And Shao Kahn.
Yeah.
Built-in soundboard.
Yeah, totally. It's hysterical.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was something I did a lot of on PlayStation. There were a lot of games that used red book audio. And then you mentioned obliquely Symphony of the Night, which did not... It had yellow book audio, but...
Has that
randomly it has one track that is red book audio that's not actually played in the game. It's just like a remix of the first area's theme that you know, it's there for you to listen to if you want to play the game in a CD player.
As you can see, this is a PlayStation black disc. Cut number one contains computer data, so please don't play it. But you probably won't listen to me anyway, will you?
Weird, but unique, and, you know, kind of one of those charming little things about the game.
And then there's, you know, Vibbobin, which uses the red book audio.
Yeah, Vibbobin.
Which also has the best soundtrack. Like,
super good.
Yeah, oh, why would you want to change it?
Yeah, that's my problem. Like, I bought a copy of that when I was in Japan, and I import PlayStation, and I was planning on putting in all my, like, Aphex Twin or weird stuff to see what it would do to it, but the original music is so good.
It is, yeah.
Such a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the advent of streaming music, you know, quote unquote, real musicians began to become involved in the creation of music. And I don't know what the first example of like a, you know, like a legitimate recording artist contributing to music would be.
I know at least one of the guys in Mr. Big does the soundtrack to the Spider-Man versus Kingpin game for the Sega CD because Mr. Big is bigger than shit in Japan. Like the massively huge there.
Hmm. Man, so. I saw them in concert one time and it was bad. I don't know why anyone would go and listen to them willingly. Hmm.
I feel like it was probably a PC game that would have had the first notable composer just, you know, on the box. Like I said, the PC was...
if you don't count Journey.
Journey, right.
Journey Escape.
Yeah.
I'm talking about, like, that was a pre-made Journey song. They didn't make an original song for the arcade game.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Let's see. You know, the earliest I can think of would be the Make My Video series, which weren't really...
No.
That wasn't quite original music.
Trent Reznor did the Quake soundtrack.
Yes.
That's right.
Which has never been released commercially.
Really?
Which is the strangest thing
about
it. But
it's strange. Is it all Red Book audio?
I'm pretty sure it is. And you can find it online in 5 minutes if you wanted it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have it, but it's never got a commercial release.
Hmm.
There were like a lot of alternative, quote unquote, alternative bands. Like I remember some racing games, like with music by God Lives Underwater. Yeah, just like who, what?
Yeah, they started. They started to license in music a lot.
What's the PlayStation like futuristic racing game?
Wipeout.
They did that a lot, right?
If we're gonna talk about the soundtrack releases later, like that's a really important one in terms of like it was the first one to get released in America. One of the first big ones to get released in America, especially on vinyl. That got released on vinyl.
Yeah,
and it has a lot of like that was of the era when electronica was supposed to break through, and it kind of didn't. But like, you know, those had Future Sound of London, Propeller Heads, Prodigy, Chemical Brothers, all this amazing music, and I think it kind of laid the course for what American video game licensed music would be for about 5 years. Like you'd see like Wing Commander had Kim FDM in it.
Yeah, I remember Gran Turismo had Ash and Garbage and just a lot of Euro rock.
And every game had Dragula.
True.
Oh, yeah. God.
That broke some records. But why'd if we're talking about, I guess, celebrity composers or people from other memes, like Harry Gregson Williams and Metal Gear Solid 2, I feel like he opened the floodgates because now every music composer is a person who works on TV shows and movies.
Right.
Like, for the big guys like EA.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much just Hideo Kojima's I Love Hollywood. I'm going to stroke my own ego by getting a Hollywood composer to do music for me.
It's not CD audio, but there's Green Jelly in Maximum Carnage.
That's right.
Spider-Man game.
Oh, man.
Did they make original music?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just basically like chiptuned.
That's versions. The hardest part because you can find a lot of early examples of licensed music in CD games like Road Rash for the 3DO.
Rock and Roll Racing.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Wow.
Chiptune. Sabbath.
Yeah, yes, it's less common to find sort of big composers who have contributed to video games. Another notable one that I think people tend to forget about was Spyro the Dragon, Stuart Copeland from The Police.
Yeah, that blew my mind when I had no idea.
Oh, but it's like Sting was writing books about tantric sex, and then Stuart Copeland was contributing something good to the world.
And I'm willing to bet I have never played Spyro, but I bet the soundtrack to Spyro is better than Sting's last album.
It's a really good soundtrack.
Yeah.
Like related to that, you know, Mark Mothersbaugh did Crash Bandicoot music, but I mean, he had also done a lot of different TV stuff.
Rugrats and whatnot.
But yeah, that was like his biggest jump into games was Crash Bandicoot.
I did not know about that. And if we're going to talk about licensed music, I would argue that the greatest licensing, the video game with the best licensed soundtrack has to be Grand Theft Auto.
Oh, God, City. Yeah.
And seven CDs of amazing 80s music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Just Grand Theft Auto in general. I mean, was that at the time where, I guess, game systems were MP3 friendly or like compressed music friendly? Because it feels like...
Well, I mean, it was, you know, that's all streaming music within the disc.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think I always thought it was interesting, like, so Grand Theft Auto 3, that was before the series took off,
right?
But they wanted to have a retro station in it, so they bought the Scarface soundtrack, because all that's Giorgio Moroder and Blondie, and not Blondie, just Debbie Harry solo.
Huh.
I'll tell you what else, you know, Rockstar, before that, released Thrasher Skate and Destroy for PS1, which also had a lot of licensed music, some old hip-hop as well, and...
You know. Well, the Tony Hawk games, too, had awesome licensed soundtracks.
Yeah, they were basically doing a Tony Hawk move, because, they're trying to get in on that.
As someone who likes electronic music, like, I think the Wipeout soundtracks are, like, they're one of the reasons why I like electronic music. So,
me too.
You know, and Crazy Taxi is one of the reasons I hate Offspring.
You know, Sega released a limited edition Dreamcast record a couple of years ago, and I got a copy. You could only if you bought the Dreamcast collection in Australia,
right?
Wow! Yes.
And I actually got someone to buy it for me, and I have a copy.
Doesn't
of that.
Jeremy have it? Didn't you get it?
Do what?
The blue vinyl?
No, not, it's white.
Oh, okay.
Not the Sega Genesis one. This is a white Dreamcast vinyl.
Why? Okay.
I have the Genesis collection.
Okay, yeah,
that's with a lot of money.
Actually, I gave that to my boss.
Okay.
A few weeks ago, because he's really into Genesis music.
And when it said music from Crazy Taxi, and but it's not. It's the music that they put in like a later version of it because they couldn't keep the Offspring song.
Oh yeah,
because of that collection and they had to.
They re-released it on XBLA and other things like that. I don't know. Do you know what they changed it to?
It's nothing. I mean, it's like, I don't know. It's completely forgettable because it's not that Offspring song.
Right,
like,
right.
I hate that Offspring song, but like, if I'm going to play Crazy Taxi, I want to hear that Offspring song. Like,
that's true.
That's that game's that's identity.
One of those things. Yeah.
Yeah, that and that. Well, who's it? Bad Religion?
Bad Religion.
Yeah.
Right.
The drag.
I do find it strange that they only decided to license four songs. Was it four songs?
Yeah,
I guess it was designed for the arcade experience, and they never thought about, you know, how is this going to stand up at home.
And that Offspring song is like 2 minutes long.
Yeah.
So you hear a lot.
Yeah.
It was the style at the time. Bay Area.
So what was the first time you guys ever bought video game music? Not within a video game, but when you bought some kind of video game music in a separate recording? Curious to hear. Ray, you've got your hand up. You're excited.
I bought those bootlegged, as I later found out, Final Fantasy soundtracks, like Symphonic Suite, the original Final Fantasy.
From Anime?
Yes.
From Sunmay.
Sunmay, that was the other one.
That was the label, yeah. So, I got a couple Final Fantasy albums. I did get official Mega Man albums, like the soundtrack from the second arcade game. And like those made up like my first three or four game soundtracks that I actually bought.
So this was like in the 90s sometime?
Yeah, late 90s. And then I got an MP3 player and things changed a bit.
Exactly.
But, you know, I was right there.
I was in a lot of tape trading scenes, like TV and music. So the first albums I got illegally were the Final Fantasy 1 and 2 Symphonic Suite. Is that right?
Yeah.
And Final Fantasy 6 Grand Finale, which is pretty bad, actually. It's a pretty bad interpretation of those songs, and I wish they would redo it. But the first time I bought a legitimate game music album was actually at an EB. And I was on vacation, and for some reason, EB would just have random import things for no reason. And they had the Mega Man Legends soundtrack.
Oh, wow.
It was actually the Rockman Dash soundtrack.
Right.
So I got to hear the opening and closing songs I never heard before. But right. I bought that at an EB in like 1999 for $12 or something. Mm-hmm. Just like, what is this doing here? I have to have it because it's here. You know?
I remember that era where EB and Babbage's had imports and stuff. Because I always kick myself for not buying Radiant Silver Gun for $50.
Oh, wait, actually, before that, actually, probably a few months before that, the first soundtrack I bought was the Mother 2 soundtrack for like $40.
Wow.
And I did not regret that.
I'll tell you what, I did buy some, but, you know, long before that, it was recording them to tape.
Yeah.
And Earthbound was a big part of that. I had a mini tape recorder, and I just put a bunch of Earthbound music on that. And
Ninja Gaiden with the sound test, Castlevania 3 with the sound test. I recorded those.
We were all doing more of that.
Mm-hmm. Like the first I bought was those Wipeout albums, and then I also bought. I think it was a promo item, but I have it somewhere. It's the Full Throttle soundtrack.
The
LucasArts game, because it had original music in it.
I know it had an opening song.
Yeah, a band called Gone Zackles. Not Zackle.
Right.
Not the 80s hair metal band, a different band, which is kind of worse. and I also bought, what's some other ones? I have so many now that it's hard to keep track of like the earliest ones, but definitely the Wipeout ones. And then a lot of the times, a game would have licensed music, and they wouldn't have a soundtrack, so I just go buy the music. Like, I remember that really bad PS1 game, Loaded.
Pop
Will Eat Itself.
Oh, okay.
Who was Clint Mansell's band, the guy who did the score Looking for a Dream.
Okay.
He started out making just the worst British hip hop and then pretty good British industrial music.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. And that's how I kind of got into it. But it wasn't until more recently when it was easier to get them, you know, because I lived in Toledo, Ohio, and we didn't have imports. And but I started to get more, and I started to buy like those Famicom collection albums and stuff like that. This is more my speed. So,
but yeah. Did you do any recording of them when you were a kid? Or?
I didn't have the know how to do that. Like nowadays, I mean, I just didn't think of it. You know, it was like I would listen to sound tests. It was like the most awesome thing in the world.
Yeah. Things like Final Fantasy VI, I did what Ray did, but with things like Final Fantasy VI and Earthbound, where there were no sound tests, you're like, okay, I know this is the only time they're going to play this song in the game, so I have to record it, because there were some songs that were like that, just like a one-and-done sort of composition that you never hear.
Yeah,
but Final Fantasy VI had an official U.S. soundtrack release.
That's right.
And I that was the first CD that I bought for game music. Hmm. CDs, actually.
Kefka's Domain.
Yep.
What's funny is one of the Resident Evil soundtracks, I forgot which one it is, it's on the label, it says first American release of a video game soundtrack, and it's a blatant lie.
That's probably RE2.
I think it was RE2. Yeah.
you know, on second thought, you talking about the Final Fantasy thing sort of reminded me that actually I did buy ones before that, and they were the ones out of the Super Power Club catalog, the Nintendo game soundtracks, like Donkey Kong Country. Then it was some N64 compilations. And
I had a copy of White Knuckle Scoring, which is a
Yes.
I had that for a long time, and then recently I found
game music.
It's not game music. It's related.
Yeah,
you know, because a lot of those Nintendo put out stuff, weird stuff like that, like those Donkey Kong ones and stuff like that.
Yeah, there was like the Mortal Kombat movie soundtrack and the Mega Man Ruby Spears cartoon soundtrack.
There's one of my favorites of that era is the Shadows of the Empire soundtrack, which has no music from the game. It's inspired by the story.
Oh, but sure.
It was released by the soundtrack label that Felicia Salabande.
Oh.
And it's like a big prestige release, has nothing to do with the game.
Well, that reminds me of like Killer Cuts. Wasn't that inspired by Mortal Kombat? And I mean, Shaq Fu came with a CD, but I don't know if any of that music was actually in the game.
Comic Zone came with a CD.
And
they're still doing the inspired Mortal Kombat. Like when they released the last game, they had music by Skrillex that was inspired by Mortal Kombat and stuff like that, you know.
Big brands.
Yeah.
But yeah, we didn't like, you know. If I would have lived in Japan, I would have got all that stuff when it first came out.
Sure.
And then ended up buying it when I was there last year. So
So you know, that I guess video game music started to kind of show up in the U.S. as official releases in the early to mid '90s, but it had been happening in Japan for a long time. Like you said, Masanobu Endo and the Zevius music.
Yeah, I mean,
showed up.
Give me one
on GMO and like things like even just the Dragon Quest III soundtrack. You know, that's always been one of the things I covet in Akihabara is an original vinyl pressing of the Dragon Quest III soundtrack.
So it started with the Super Zevius Hardcore Mix, which is a single, I think, in 84. And
I have that.
Not
the physical.
Sorry. Okay, so then
listen to
but even before that, Yellow Magical Orchestra's first album had remixes of Space Invaders. And a game called Circus, which was released as Atari Circus, I think, in America. But then from that, you had like one of the guys from YMO, the Hiromi Hanaso, released video game music in 84. And then Return to Video Game Music the following year. And that was the first GMO release. And like from like 86 to 88, it was like a floodgate to stuff. You'd get these collections of Famicom music or Namco, and they would just release, and they weren't arranged, they were just straight up the game music on vinyl.
Jeez.
And then tape, you know, eventually. And then,
sorry.
I think it got, you know, I didn't think you'd get a full game soundtrack until Gradius. And then the Dragon's Quest ones were the really big ones. And those are the first ones you'd get like orchestral versions of. Like, I have the Dragon's Quest 2 one.
Yeah, there's a lot of really twangy guitars. It sounds so 80s.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it has a full orchestral version, like an honest to goodness orchestral version. And then the B side, the second side is just gameplay audio. And when I mean it's gameplay audio, you even hear
like
text.
A recording of
like a text of somebody playing the video game.
Going up and down the stairs.
It's really weird. And even like in the late 80s in Japan, you'd even get vinyl releases of some American games, like because they love Ultima, or just Western games. Like
right.
There's an Ultima one and Wizardry, of course, because Wizardry was huge there. And but like, and then even in up until the late 80s, you'd even get some tape only releases, because I think at that point vinyl was becoming less popular in Japan, so they just went tape, and but for some reason not CD. So you'd have like MSX versions of soundtracks released on tapes.
Yeah, there's a weird...
I've never seen video game, like, official original soundtrack releases on cassette tape.
Yeah, I double-checked to make sure they weren't bootlegs, and they are legitimate releases.
The song I ended the Captain N episode with is from a single release, and it, one side is Kid Icarus, the other side is Metroid. It was never available in any other format aside from a cassette tape.
There were lot of cassette tape promos, even in America.
Right. Yeah.
You get those with arcade games sometimes for some reason. But, like, that would happen now. And then the last major vinyl release in Japan I could find was Dragon's Quest IV. And that was on vinyl, cassette, and CD. And then after that, they were cassette and CD.
That was probably, 1990-ish?
Yeah, 1990.
Okay.
And now you get them on vinyl again because vinyl's come back. Like, there was that Final Fantasy vinyls.
Yeah,
which I thought was really funny because the plural of vinyl is vinyl.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's called Final Fantasy vinyls. And stuff like that. But like he said, we didn't get American releases until the mid-90s. And honestly, the one of the earliest ones I could find, like in researching, was Myst, which was packed with the game.
Oh yeah.
And for some reason, there was a release of the Primal Raid soundtrack.
Well, that's so weird.
Sure.
Who needed that in their life?
Nobody.
I mean, you're mentioning this, and I do want to bring up the fact that in the late '90s, companies like Working Designs mm-hmm. and Atlas were sort of making the soundtrack a premium, where if you reserve the game, or maybe if you just want to buy the overpriced collector's edition, you'll get the soundtrack with it. And now I feel like a lot of American game companies, that's just the obligatory thing. If you buy the horrible, you know, exclusive edition with the cat helmet and the night vision goggles, they'll just like throw a CD in there. Here, have fun with this.
Or it's a pre-order bonus.
Like,
In the UK, the pre-order bonus for the last Driver game was the soundtrack on vinyl.
Yeah.
And it's a great soundtrack too. But my favorite example of that was if you bought a Jaguar CD, it came with the CD soundtrack to Tempest 2000.
Oh, wow.
Which is an awesome electronic, like, acid house soundtrack. And so, like, I have a friend who runs a video game store, and I convinced her to buy that so I can get the CD.
Mm-hmm. That's worth it.
I thought so. It's a great soundtrack.
It's only good unless you get like the sampling or like selection or whatever, where it's three songs or five songs, because Japanese composers or developers are stingy with getting those rights.
Yeah.
So I have one of my first official CDs was the Chrono Cross. You know, you pre-order Chrono Cross, you get mm-hmm. like the three. Was the it three songs?
It was part of the Summer of Adventure.
That's right. But was it three? Was it three songs? It had to
I
be like
it was four.
Okay. But still, I mean, it was still impressive just to have it, like, wow, game music on a CD in 1999 or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, whenever I would see one used somewhere, like in the late 90s, that when I went to college, it would blow my mind.
Mm.
I mean, that even existed.
Yeah.
Like, seeing ones for, like, Castlevania and stuff like that, it was just awesome. And then when I went to Japan and finding out I can get them on vinyl, I was like, because I love buying records.
Oh, yeah.
So it seems anachronistic to buy this digitally made music.
An analog format,
which I always think is kind of funny. And one of the things I always thought was weird about, like, when you get into, like, the late 90s in America of, like, licensed music, like, they were never really soundtracks, I guess because it would cost too much.
Mm.
But, like Road Rash 3DO has a great soundtrack with Soundgarden and a band called Therapy.
Oh, yeah, I had a friend with a 3DO, I do remember that.
But then they released a soundtrack to Road Rash 3D, which had Kid Rock and Sugar Ray.
Hell yeah. Wait, no. So, I just see frosted tips when you mention those bands.
But, you know, we still haven't seen video game music enter the true mainstream with a top 40 radio hit in America.
Yeah. Mm.
It hasn't. Do you think we ever will? Oh, yeah, yeah. Eyes on Me from Final Fantasy VIII was a huge hit over there.
I feel like even with movies, the era of the soundtrack is sort of stalled out a bit. There used to be these big singles tied in with movie releases, but not like so much anymore.
Titanic or The Bodyguard.
Yeah, but even
in the 80s, like Footloose
and
Flashdance.
Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, there'd always be like, this is a song we're going to sell the movie with. Yeah. But I feel like that era of the movie soundtrack being important, or like soundtracks being important in general, is over. There's no Trojan horse to, like, wheel into people's houses.
I think with the rise of digital singles on iTunes,
that too,
you might be able to get a single from a video game soundtrack to chart.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't get, like, an actual soundtrack.
Yeah, but even assholes like the Retronauts can chart on iTunes. So.
Well, that's
it. Yeah, but I mean, also, it's the way of selling music has changed, where you would buy the Robin Hood soundtrack, you'd get your Bryan Adams, and then you have to suffer through everything else you didn't want to listen to. Now you can just single in on that CD or that song, the soundtrack isn't as important anymore. Right. Bryan Adams, people. Take him or leave
him. I'll leave him.
So we need to kind of wrap things up. We're getting on to an hour and a half now.
Yikes.
But, before we go, I wanted to ask, what is everyone's favorite video game composer? Name one and tell me why.
Oh, man, I need a minute.
I can go.
Do it,
please.
you Yuzo Koshiro. Yuzo Koshiro, you know, like follow up for what I said, Streets of Rage 2 and Resident Shinobi. When I actually bought a CD copy of the Bare Knuckle 2 soundtrack, which cost more than almost anything else I bought in Japan, but it was worth it.
Yeah, I do feel Koshiro is kind of like I like his music now more than I used to, because I feel like he's sort of keeping that that ethos alive, like that classic video game composition style that no one else really does. Maybe Minami Matsumae will do something with Mighty Number 9 that will make us proud.
Ooh, I hope so.
I'll name mine. I guess it's still Yasunori Mitsuda of Chrono Trigger, Chrono Cross.
What's he been doing recently?
He doesn't do much these days. I haven't seen anything with his name on it in quite a while. I think, you know, maybe he just kind of got tired of video games.
Aww.
Which I can kind of understand. The sort of games that he composed music for don't really sell. They're not even really made anymore. So he did a DS game. I can't even remember what it was called. I reviewed it, but I didn't enjoy it that much. But it had a great soundtrack. It was like Deep Labyrinth or something.
Oh, yeah. I have that soundtrack, actually.
Yeah.
I had that game.
Yeah.
Also, he has a collection of original music called Kirite,
right,
from like a decade ago. It's really good.
I think he may still be working on the Chrono Cross Arranged soundtrack that he's been promising for a decade.
Forgot about that.
Yeah.
I guess I'll go. Can I name a collective? Because there's
like Zuntada or Konami Kukeya.
That's who I wanted to mention, because as time has passed, I mean, as much as I love Earthbound and Final Fantasy soundtracks, I've grown to love the parodious music, as goofy as it is. Jeremy discovered this in an interview. I don't know if it's public knowledge, but the...
It is, yeah.
Well, like the reason that they use public domain music, it was out of necessity because they needed music fast, and that was the only way to do it, you know, because, you know, it's there, just play with it. And those soundtracks are so good. I mean, parodious has become gross and disgusting and this other thing I don't even want to talk about. But I feel like that was... how do you even say the middle word?
Konami Kukeha
Club. Kukeha?
Kukeha.
Kukeha. Well, I mean, I feel like that was just the kind of the peak of their creative talent, just all smashing together on those parodious games. And I recommend look up Sexy Parodious, and you'll have a good time with that music.
I love the like the live albums they performed. Like there are these kind of rockin' live performances that they did of, you know, Castlevania music and stuff. It's great.
And one thing, there's this guy on YouTube. I think he's, I forget his name, but if you just look up NES soundtracks in stereo, you'll find him. Mm-hmm. And he has a ton of Konami games, stuff like Mission Impossible and Monster in My Pocket, even like Bucky O'Hare. They sound so good in stereo.
I thought you were going to say Smooth McGroove.
Smooth? I don't even know what that is.
He's the dude who does the like the multi-part a cappella renditions of game music.
Oh, I forgot. Oh, yeah. I don't think I've seen
any
of stuff.
He's always holding a cat.
Okay. Does he have a huge beard?
Yes.
Okay. I know who that is now. But yeah, look up that guy. It's like Wii Guy. I forget. I don't know. But he's got a lot of great Konami soundtracks on there, if you don't believe me.
Yeah, we kind of missed out on discussing the in-house bands that sort of cropped up around the.
I guess we'll have to do another music retronaut
sometime. So, anyway, for me, you know, I'm a big fan and really want to be a big booster of Kota Hoshino from Software, who does, you know, Armored Core, I guess, most prominently. But, you know, his stuff for the Evergrace games, especially, is just like. It sounds really annoying, I guess, at first, but to me, it's just really magical stuff.
Did he do Demon's Souls as well?
No.
Okay, I'm just curious.
But
did he do 3D Dot Game Heroes?
No.
No.
Because it was a separate developer, really. I mean, it's just really ethereal, sort of magical stuff, and I enjoyed a lot. Lots of layering on, like, strings and chants and stuff, especially in Evergrace and Evergrace 2. And, you know, even now his newest Armored Core stuff is really good. And, I like him a lot. Number two, I guess, also Mitsuto Suzuki, who does stuff for Square Enix now, but he's also really good, like, electronic kind of guy.
Can you name what he's worked on? I haven't heard the name before.
He's mostly done, like, contributions to stuff, you know, like the Final Fantasy 13s most recently.
Oh, yeah, he was the other guy on 10, wasn't he? There was Umatsu and Hamauzu. And wasn't he the third one?
I'm drawing a blank.
Me too.
I think he came a little bit later, actually. So
I can never remember the third guy.
He's not really tied to any one franchise there. But, you know, he's released his singles under Square Enix's label as well, and he's pretty good.
Hmm. All right.
Oh,
well,
I'm good.
No,
okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is your one chance.
This is your shot.
I was going to mention one thing since you brought up the live stuff. I got some... There was a magazine in Japan called Beep.
Sure.
But that lasted forever.
I think that magazine...
It just recently folded.
I want to say...
Last name.
Right, but I want to say that that's where Akitoshi Kawazu got his start, writing for that magazine, creator of the Saga games.
But they would release flexi discs with the magazine back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I have... You mentioned the live one. I have a flexi disc recording of a Namco charity concert for Christmas. That has
Flexi discs. Is that vinyl? Is it
like
record player?
Plastic vinyl.
Yeah. And you put a penny in the center.
If you have to.
Okay.
And I have two of them, and they have there's a live Namco charity concert that has all this amazing orchestra.
Oh, wow.
And
have you ripped these?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
I can give you. They're on my site right now.
Oh, cool! I need to check out your site.
Yeah, yep. and
LostTurntable.com.
That's one on LostTurntable.com. Yeah, most of the music I host is on that because there's no ads there, so I don't.
You know what? I think that's the one thing I downloaded from your site before I even actually met you.
I also put up an amazing version of the Chase HQ theme that was remixed.
Oh,
that has the if you like that slap bass sound, it's all that.
Nice. Who doesn't?
Yeah. I'm gonna steal all of your bandwidth when I get home.
Unlimited, go nuts.
Okay, well, that wraps it up for this discussion of video game music on Retronauts. Join us next week when we talk about it even more. Actually, no, that's not right. I don't know what's next
episode. Hey, why not?
we'll probably talk about video game music in some capacity. Oh, actually, we will, because next week is the Quintet episode, and you can't talk about Quintet without talking about those freaking amazing soundtracks.
Yeah. Our buddy Yuzo Koshiro.
So there
Koshiro.
You go. More Yuzo Koshiro.
That'll be my only contribution to that episode. I'm here.
Well, I don't know if you're going to be here. We'll have to see if you die in between.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you, James, our guest.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Pimp yourself out a little more.
Please do.
Best way to find my stuff is on, if you just follow me on Twitter, it's Lost Turntable. LostTurntable.com and mostly Webto.com. I write for a few magazines here and there that I'm not going to talk about. So.
All right.
Wow.
And we here at Retronauts are all over the internet.
Right.
We're just vandalizing it here and there.
Can I just say, a few people have reached out to me and they say, Bob, how do we figure out what songs you're using on your show? And I say, go to Retronauts.com.
If only you listened to the tagline at the end of the podcast,
yes,
where we tell you to go to Retronauts.com.
Where is that?
Retronauts.com.
You know, we're just going to stop the podcast right now until you go there. Go ahead. We're waiting. Okay, now you see. See, yep. It's all there.
We're also on retronauts.tumblr.com, where mainly we pimp the podcast, but I also occasionally reblog stuff that amuses me. We're on Twitter, at Retronauts. We're on Facebook, as Retronauts. And if we ever do anything with our YouTube channel, we're there, too, as Retronauts.
Mm-hmm.
And is there anything else? Am I overlooking anything?
Rate and review the show. We are constantly in the top 10. If you want us to stay there, please send us your reviews. Well, don't send them to us because we don't know what to do with them. But
if we input all your reviews, we'd get banned from gaming the system.
But please, if you haven't, take a few minutes out of your day to give us a 5-star, 4-star, whatever star rating on iTunes and write up a few sentences about what you like about the show. Or just say, something ridiculous. I don't think they'll boot you out for that.
Right. And tell everyone on the Retronauts Reddit that we're awesome, too. No, actually, don't do that.
Is there one?
No.
Okay.
Retro Games Reddit.
I'm sure
there's plenty. Anyway, Ray, do you have any contributions for this segment?
No.
Okay, good.
Love it.
We can end.
You did
all right.
Great.
We love you, everyone. Thanks for supporting us.
Thank you.
We'll give you hugs next time we see you. But until then, I'm Jeremy Parrish, and this was another episode of... That's right, Retronauts.